Good morning. Hi, I'm Scott Tenona. I'm a member of the fellowship here. You're welcome here, whatever your background, whatever your belief system. We ask only that we each strive to keep an open mind and a warm heart. We encourage everybody to engage in discussion and conversation. And we will have conversation afterwards in the narthex with some coffee. So if you're new here, please feel free to join us for that. I draw your attention to the announcements that are on this side of the order of service. Indicate things that are going on during the week, things you might be interested in. And in addition to this, I've been asked to make just an announcement to say if you can't hear what's going on up here, we do have, if you haven't noticed before, headsets. So they're in the back there. So please feel free either to get up and get one or, you know, I don't know, kind of raise your hand or something and somebody will go and help you out. All right, I want to say a few words about the service today, because the service originated from discussions between participants and myself on the topic of atheism, and among other things, what ways there are of characterizing atheism in terms of what an atheist believes rather than what an atheist doesn't believe. And this kind of discussion is important. There's a recent Pew study, and I don't know if any of you have seen this, there's a recent Pew study showing that reports that roughly half of the Americans polled say they would be unhappy if an immediate family member were to marry someone who doesn't believe in God, 49%. So they'd be unhappy with that. Now, to compare that number, 11% say they'd be unhappy if somebody married a different race, if an immediate family member married somebody of a different race, 49% versus 11% in terms of the, either what they believe or what they're willing to report they believe. Among those who report themselves to be consistently liberal, almost as many report that they would be unhappy with an atheist marrying into the family as they would be with a born-again Christian marrying into the family. So those who say they're consistently liberal, 24% would be unhappy with an atheist marrying into the family, 27% would be unhappy with a born-again Christian marrying into the family. Unitarian Universalism is a haven for atheists, agnostics, secular humanists, and other lost souls looking for community. Secular concerns for social action, interest in intellectual exploration of religion, science, philosophy, human psychology, and helping children develop a strong sense of self and a good moral compass. These have all been motivations for many people for participation in and founding of Unitarian Universalist fellowships, and this fellowship is no different in that respect. Unitarian Universalism, of course, draws from a variety of other religious traditions, including Buddhism, besides Christianity in our roots, including Buddhism, earth-based religions, and the members of this fellowship have a wide range of beliefs, including Christian and other theistic worldviews, and a variety of spiritual but not traditionally theistic ones. Within that wide range, we do find a good many atheists and secular humanists, and in our service today, we're going to hear from just a subset of them, but we should have good time for discussion at the end. I hope people will chime in. I'm going to light our chalice today with a few questions to ask yourself from Charles Templeton. Is it not likely that had you been born in Cairo, you would be a Muslim, and, as at the time as he was writing, 840 million people do, would believe that there is no God but God and Muhammad is his prophet? If you had been born in Calcutta, would you not, in all probability, be a Hindu, and, as 650 million people do, accept the Vedas and the Upanishads as sacred scriptures? Is it not probable that had you been born in Jerusalem, you would be a Jew, and as some 13 million people do, believe that Yahweh is God and the Torah is God's will? Is it not likely that had you been born in Beijing, you would be one of the millions who accept the teachings of the Buddha or Confucius or Lao Tzu, and you would strive to follow their teachings and examples? Now, please stand as you're able and join me in singing hymn number 135, How Happy Are They? 135. Now's the time in our order of service where we join in community to share some of the joys and sorrows we have as individuals so that the burdens of our sorrows may be lightened somewhat by community support and our individual joys may brighten the lives of others. So if you have a joy or sorrow you'd like to share, please do so now and the mic will run around.
This is Ann Cowan. I had a joy this last week of visiting Charlie and Nancy Perkins in Seattle, and they send their greetings to everyone. They're doing quite well. Charlie is now 97 years old. They took me out to lunch, and we had a nice visit. I do have a couple of photos on my phone if anybody wants to see them afterwards.
I have a joy. My grandson, Evan Johnson, is visiting me this weekend. He has spent the last year in Russia teaching English and has enjoyed his experience there so much he's going back next week.
Yeah, cool.
So he's full of information.
Well, I have a joy. My two daughters and my son-in-law came out from Kansas City to hear me speak this morning, and I'm glad to have their support. It's Madeline and her two and Peter and their two kids, Clementine and Sylvie. And then my fourth daughter, Marjorie, is here too, so from Kansas City.
I'm Bobette McGoy, and we are happy to have our daughter Karen here visiting for a week from California.
Wow. I'm Sabrina Boker. I got a joy. My brother, well, at first my brother lost his job on Tuesday, and Thursday he got a new job on at some kind of manufacturing plant, and he said the people there are real cool, so... It's going to be real. He thinks he's going to enjoy it.
Good. Hi. I wasn't here the Sunday after, but a couple weeks ago on Saturday, my daughter Phoebe came to visit, and she and I came to the work day, and we built a little path going up the hill, so that was a real joy for me.
Thank you, Pat Embers. I have some sad news. Diane Barker's mother died, I think it was a couple weeks ago, or it wasn't last week, the week before, and the memorial will be in Oklahoma July 2nd or 3rd.
Diane Barker's mother. We hold in the heart, in our hearts, the joys and sorrows of the community that were shared. We also hold a space in our hearts for those that were not shared today. All right, now is time for the moment for all ages. The kids will come on up. We'll chat a bit. Come on up. You going to read something? You going to sing for us? Play an instrument? No? All right, I want to share a really cool thing that happened to me. I got a cut right there. And you know what? It fixed itself. It's better. Isn't that amazing? I mean, it's amazing. You ever think about your skin? You think about your skin? What? Lots and lots of sunburns? Oh, yeah, in the summer. Yeah, you have to worry about, and bug bites, oh, and it itches. That's an annoying part of your skin, isn't it? What are the cool parts of your skin? That it fixes itself? Keeps all the stuff in? I mean, isn't that good? I'm really happy I don't have stuff, like, falling out. And it grows. Yeah, when you get bigger, it grows with you. And it lets water out, right? When you sweat and you get hot, does it let water in? If you're thirsty, can you just put your fingers in some water and just soak it up? No? Sometimes? A little bit? Yeah, kind of if they're dry again, but it doesn't. It lets it out, but it doesn't let it in. Skin's cool. Our bodies are cool. Let me show you something. That's just one of the many, many things I can do with my body. I mean, this is pretty cool. Can you all do cool things with your bodies? Anybody? Oh, I'm not sure if I can do it with other hands. It's not. So I only practice with those. Can anybody do cool things with your body? Oh, look at that. Look at that. Cool. That's a cool thing. Any cool things you can do with your body? Do you want to say it or do you want to do it? Okay. He's going to do it.
I can actually do what you just did.
Oh, okay. Do what I just did. Let's see it. All right. Way to go. Any other cool things with your body? Can everybody stand on one foot? Can you do that? Yeah? That's pretty good. Pretty neat. And what other... Can anybody play soccer or kick balls? Yeah? What other cool things can you do with your body? Liam has three balls. Different kinds of... Three soccer balls. Yeah? So you play soccer a lot. Yeah. What else can you do?
Your head can hold all your hair.
Oh, your head can hold all your hair, and that's a pretty cool thing, isn't it? Yeah. Something cool. Yeah, something interesting right there with your body. Okay. Now, let me ask you another question. Is there anything cool you can do with your brain, your mind? Can you do cool things with your mind?
I can think.
You can think. That is, I think, one of the most amazing things ever.
You can dream and then write stories.
Ooh, that is pretty amazing, too. What else can you do with your brain? Any cool things you can do with your brain? Can everybody add?
No.
How many of you can add? 2 plus 2, you know how to do that? How many of you can count, actually? Let's do 1, 2, 3. We all know how to count, right? Yeah?
You kick the ball, bounce it.
Kick it and bounce it?
Yeah.
That's impressive. Yeah. And numbers, you can all count? Has anybody heard of a negative number? Yeah. Do you know, I mean, it was a long time before people sort of thunk up the idea of negative numbers.
I have 2 bikes.
You have 2 bikes? That's cool. We can count the number of bikes we have, but you never count to a negative number, do you? You go 1, 2, 3. Where are the negative? They're kind of, it was kind of hard to figure it out.
1, 2.
1, 2.
Yeah. And how about imaginary numbers? Has everybody thought of, heard of imaginary numbers? Yeah.
I haven't heard of one, but I do know about the negative ones. -1, -2, -3, -4, and it keeps going on.
And it keeps going on, he said. It does keep on going on, yeah? No, nothing? So imaginary numbers, isn't this weird? Imaginary is a kind of number that doesn't really exist, but then it does because we thought it up. And, you know, we actually have to use it. We use it in some of our science. You need the imaginary numbers, it kind of turns out. I think this is a neat thing. So, you know why I'm talking about all this? I want to tell you why I'm saying all this stuff. Because I think human beings are pretty amazing.
Hmm?
You have a lot of cars? Yeah. I think human beings are pretty darn amazing. We are capable of some pretty amazing things. And I have another kind of question for y'all. Do your parents or teachers or adults sometimes tell you just what the rules are, and you have to just follow the rules? Does that happen sometimes? A lot. Yeah? Well, how often does it also happen? Hmm?
You have grown-ups?
Yeah.
Piper has grown-ups. I have some grown-ups, too. Yeah, grown-ups are cool. Kids are cool. I am a grown-up, I know. And, you know, when I was talking about how amazing my body is, it doesn't do as many things as you... I'm not old, but I'm not like young anymore either. It doesn't do all the things I'd like, but I still think it's pretty amazing and cool. And I'm pretty happy with this thing too.
Hmm?
Lots of things you got. So I got a question for you now though. Even though a lot of you got a lot of rules that you follow, does anybody ever tell you that you have to figure stuff out on your own? Yeah? Do you hear that a lot? You have to figure stuff out on your own? Yeah? Oh, well, I don't think that's true at all. Now, I got a question for you about this.
I play zombies and
Black Ops. Oh, okay. A lot of things you play.
I play zombies.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Okay. Well, so let me ask. Yeah, we got some zombie discussion going on up here, which is totally cool. But I've got another question for us all. Hold on. So here's another thing I want to ask. So there's a song you sing a lot of times when you go back there, right? And it has to do with the principles, the seven principles. Could you all sing those for? Because not all, some of the adults know this, but not all the adults do it. Could you all sing this together with me? A few of us? Come on. So how does it go? Do I need a partner? Yeah. Can we all do partners? I don't know how to do all the partner stuff. I know the song, but I don't know the partner stuff. Could somebody teach me the partner stuff? Okay. All right, thanks. Ready? All right, so how does it go? Do you want to sing it?
One, each person is worthwhile.
Two, be kind in all you do. Three, we help each other learn. Four, in the search for what is true. Five, people have a say. Six, work for a peaceful world. Seven, the web of life's the way. Oh, and it'll bring us back to you and you and you and you and you. Cool. Thanks. So, in that, are there any things that tell you that you are cool? Any of those principles say that you're cool? In your own way? How about each person has a say? Isn't that telling us each that we each get to figure things out?
People's bodies. Younger people have more energy.
They do. They do. All right. So, yeah. So I think search for what is true. Each person has a say, right? Work for a peaceful world. These are all things about you. And you, and you, and how cool you all are, and how much you can figure things out on your own and figure it out, right? And I just think that's a great message. We're going to be talking about things that are like that today in the service once you leave, okay? Thanks for chatting with me, and I'll hear more about zombies later, okay? All right. So I started us out, the topic today is atheism, but I wanted to talk with kids a little bit about humanism, because I think it's a framework that sort of brings all things together. Here's a definition of humanism from the International Humanist and Ethical Union. Humanism is a democratic and ethical life stance which affirms that human beings have the right and the responsibility to give meaning and shape to their own lives. It stands for the building of a more humane society through an ethic based on human and other natural values, in the spirit of reason and free inquiry, through human capabilities. And the last line of this definition, from the IHEU, says, it is not theistic, and therefore does not accept supernatural views of reality. I share this reading because, as I've said before, I think that Unitarian Universalism is a humanism, in the sense of everything in IHEU's definition before that last line. And humanism has been used, you know, in the past to be that sort of inclusive sense. We all believe that we each have our own responsibility to give meaning and shape to our own lives. In my mind, then, some Unitarian Universalists are religious humanists, some are spiritual but not overly religious humanists, and some are secular humanists. And that last line from the IHEU definition expresses something that's more that secular humanist aspect, and expresses the belief that some of us have, but we're all humanists in the rest of that sense, I think. None of us accept without critique doctrines forced upon us. And I've thought a bit about that general sort of humanism and about what it means to rely on reason and free inquiry to develop an ethical sense, and I just want to give a few words to frame what we're going to be doing afterwards. I would say, following people like Daniel Kahneman and others, that if you really want to know the truth, you should generally not pay attention to your quick, intuitive thinking, the instantaneous stuff and instead pay attention to the slow, deliberate, statistical, mathematical, scientific methods we have of compiling and analyzing evidence. But that prescription, as Kahneman and others say, depends on your goals. Sometimes knowing that a particular important truth is important, and other times, other things are more important than the truth. I ask you just to consider for a moment the recommendation that one sometimes hears from advice columnists about affairs. Sometimes in marriages and relationships. Sometimes knowing the truth of whether an affair happened or not isn't worth it, and we're better off knowing. Now, I don't know if that's right or not, but you get the idea. You've heard this before, that sometimes maybe you don't need to know the truth. I'd say that while we can reason about what our goals should be, given other goals, no amount of reason or rationality alone can tell you what your fundamental goals should be, whether the truth really matters for you. And some truths can't be discovered by empirical means. I was thinking of this last week. I want to make a connection. When Stephanie Mott, an amazing transsexual woman from Topeka, spoke about her experiences and her faith. She was describing how important was the first time she was truly accepted as a woman. She felt truly accepted as a woman. And she said how important it was also, though, that she got over her struggle with what people had told her about God and what God accepts and what God believes. And she decided for herself that she was accepted in God's eyes as she was, as a woman. And that said something to me. I want to put aside entirely, just for the moment, because we're going to be talking more about this later, the question about the truth of whether God exists or doesn't exist, and what he or she thinks, or anything else like that. Because the way I see it, whether there really is a God or not is irrelevant. So whether there is or not is irrelevant to the benefit that Stephanie's faith gave her. The faith gave her the courage to step outside those doors where she had been embraced and to feel herself accepted even when others in society weren't accepting her as they ought to have. Now, one of the most amazing things, I think, about Unitarian Universalism is its emphasis on reason and logic and the goal of learning truth. This is one of these principles that we've got. We also have a strong respect for individuals, for caring and openness, for dialogue and community. And at its best, I think, Unitarian Universalism pulls together all these strands and asks us each to safely push our own boundaries and to question our own views when it makes sense to do so. We heard last week, and we've heard in other weeks in our Spectrum of Spirituality series, stories of how people's faith and their religious traditions have provided them with meaning and purpose in their lives. And today, we're going to hear stories of how people don't need belief in a divine being in order to have faith and purpose and meaning in their lives. After the offertory, members Ann Martian, Dave Lambert, and Dick Beeman are going to speak to us about these and other related ideas. For now, we're going to have the offertory. Take a moment, enjoy the music Renee is going to play for us, and remember that your contributions help the fellowship work towards its vision of standing for our principles and sharing messages of hope and love in the community. Thank you.
morning. Even saying the words, "I am an atheist," can be seen as an assault on some people's beliefs. That is not my intention. I speak for myself and the conclusions I've reached in my own life. I'm an atheist because, as a child, I was encouraged by my family to think and question. I'm curious now and have always been. I am skeptical of statements that have poor or no reproducible evidence. I love truth and justice. I care about people and am dismayed by the damage caused by some religions. A little bit of my history. I started to question early. My dad was raised as a Mormon. I don't know when he rejected those beliefs, but I know he hated the racism of Mormonism. And I think his college education as a chemist and his travels as a naval officer during World War II led him to a more science-based view. My mother trained as a registered nurse and also serving overseas during World War II, told me when she was a child she was kicked out of Lutheran catechism for asking too many questions and considered herself to be an agnostic. By the way, she's celebrating her 100th birthday on July 18th. So I feel fortunate that I didn't have to throw off indoctrination or reject or be rejected by my family as I discovered my inability to accept Christianity or a belief in a supernatural entity. Although my family attended Mormon services throughout my childhood, around the time I was 12 years old, I realized that I didn't believe the stories about religion that I was learning. My siblings and I sort of went on strike and stopped attending church. I think my mother was relieved. She had promised my Mormon grandmother that she would raise us as Mormons, and she did her best. At the age of 12, when I told my friends in Scott City, the western Kansas town of about 5,000 people where I grew up, that I didn't believe in God, they were horrified and tried to convince me otherwise, then decided to defriend me. Being friendless at that age was very painful. I learned quickly for survival to cover up what I felt as some kind of flaw or failure, thinking maybe my family and myself were all mutants. Everyone I knew was religious. It was easy to hide my invisible affliction, so after a few months, I had friends again. I remember deciding to read the Bible. There was a lot of strange stuff: slavery, sell your daughters, kill your son, kill the witches, plagues, women shouldn't speak in church, don't eat shrimp, punish children for their parents' acts, and much, much more. Also, learning about other world religions, the Aztec, the Inca, Maya, Egyptian sun worship, Buddhism, Islam, how could Christians be so sure they were right? How could anyone be right when there were so many choices? From that time on, it seems that on an almost daily basis, I hear or read or see something that confirms my conviction that we would be better off without religion, and that it is so highly improbable as to be impossible, that there is an entity or entities who created the universe, let alone intervene in our lives. I'll also mention the books by my favorite atheist authors, the strident atheist, Dawkins, Hitchens, Harris, also Dan Barker, the author of Godless, who spoke here at UUFM a few years ago, and Michael Shermer, editor of the Skeptical Inquirer magazine. Reading these books has brought me such joy and a feeling of belonging. Knowing there are others who think like me replaces the alienation I felt from being an atheist in a religious world. Discovering the American Humanist Association about 7 years ago was a great step forward for me, and becoming a Unitarian Universalist has helped me feel accepted and less vulnerable. I can understand the comfort belief has brought to humans for thousands of years and in hundreds or thousands of cultures in a very dangerous universe. I know how strong the human need is to keep your family, tribal group, or religious community, how deep our culture and teachings reach into our personalities. I still feel very fortunate and confident that my convictions are based on reason and evidence. I love this world and my place in it. One of the reasons I like to create art, and I have a painting hanging out in the
Paul, just a plug there, is to express my adoration of and awe and wonder at our world. I find it unnecessary to include a word, God, or an entity as a maker or as relevant. At one time, if our physics is correct, it was all a dot. At some time, an interaction between my primate brain and human language brought my consciousness into being. It's only in the last century that it has become relatively safe to admit to atheism. There are still a dozen countries where it is a crime punishable by death. It would be hard to estimate how many atheists in the world are and have been kept silent by fear of being rejected or discriminated against or even harmed physically. The term atheist means a lack of belief in God or gods. I prefer being called a secular humanist, since I have faith in the power of human beings to improve our lives. Since we have discovered and refined the tool of science, the quality of our lives has improved exponentially. I will continue to expect science, not prayer, to reduce our suffering and disease, bring better living conditions to our fellow human beings, to bring us to a better understanding of the human phenomena through neuroscience, and to help us understand how to reduce acts of religious intolerance and violence. One question we speakers today were given as a possible topic was, is belief in a supreme being necessary to promote happiness, instill a sense of purpose, or strengthen our ethics and morals? My response to that question is obviously no, no, and no. I have found meaning, purpose, an avenue for exploration of ethics, and enough happiness as an atheist here at the UUFM. I like this verse given to me by Anna Franklin during a yoga class. Walk in the light of love, bend through the darkest times, reach out to those in need, and bless who you are. Our fellow human beings, I am so grateful for the existence of the UUs. I always feel at home with UUs, and I'm always sure that my point of view will be respected and understood here. Thank you all for being a part of this caring community. I love our principles and believe that they can lead us all to a better world.
Thank you, Ann. I tried very hard to make this a personal journey kind of talk. I'll let you decide whether or not I failed or not. What paths have led me to reject the idea of a heavenly designer sitting out all of the game pieces 6,000 years ago and preordaining each of our movements, including possibly our salvation? I don't buy this model. Equally likely, nor do any of you, and I would guess neither do most of the adherents of most of the world's major religions, though I haven't asked them recently. I know Calvinists used to believe this, and Rick Perry probably still does. So what is the spiritual journey angle on my rejection of a supreme being? I guess this comes down to rationality taking precedence over faith. I cannot accept on faith alone. Carl Sagan wrote a story many years ago called The Dragon in My Garage. He asserts to a skeptic that there is a dragon in his garage. Like all skeptics, his guest offers numerous ways to detect the dragon, all of which prove untenable, because the dragon is invisible, the dragon floats, emits heatless flames, etc., etc., etc. The story becomes even more complex as all of the neighbors insist they also have dragons living in their garages. Again, these dragons are undetectable. The only outcome is to accept that millions of dragons live in millions of garages around the world, or to reject their existence because there can be no proof. If there is no way to disprove the common assertion, no conceivable way to counter the proposition, what does it mean to say that the dragons exist? Not being able to invalidate the assertion in no way proves that there are millions of dragons floating around in the world's garages. You cannot prove a negative, that there are no dragons in these garages, if faith is the only argument for the existence of these magical dragons. The basic tenets of my beliefs, that there are no dragons, nor unicorns, nor Zeus, nor gods rests on two foundations. First, I have always felt that it is somewhat arrogant to believe that all of this was created just for us. I especially like the timeline you have all seen of Homo sapiens' time on Earth. If we set midnight, January 1st, as the beginning of the planet, some 4.5 billion years ago, our species did not appear until 22 minutes to midnight on December 31st. So was God playing tiddlywinks this entire time? And if so, who was he playing with? The second foundation of my belief rests on an acceptance of chance. The span of time since the Big Bang is as vast as a Christian's concept of God. There have been many millions of happy accidents over this vastness of time. There have also been many millions of not so happy accidents leading to evolutionary dead ends. Although I do doubt that combining monkeys, typewriters, and incredibly long periods of time would result in the complete works of Shakespeare, a series of happy monkey accidents might lead to see Spot run. Humans might just be Spot. There again, the bees in the Alsop room are also Spot. And Thumper, one of our dogs, is also Spot. And who can refute that that complete Shakespearean volume might indeed exist 1,000 light years away from our insignificant little planet? By not accepting the existence of a supreme designer, I do not pretend to be modern, although it might be cool these days to reject the precepts of traditional theism. Doubts and questions have pervaded human writings over the millennia, though such doubts seldom make it to Fox News. About a year ago, I stumbled upon the writings of Lucretius, a Roman philosopher and poet living and writing over 2,000 years ago. His poem, On the Nature of Things, speaks directly to me. Lucretius addresses numerous issues in his poem, very, very long poem, which I challenge any of you to try to get through, even though Scott might have already read it. Writing in about 50 BCE, Lucretius wrote, "The universe has no creator or designer. Consequently," these are my own words, "there is no purpose to existence, only ceaseless creation and destruction, governed entirely by chance." Lucretia writes, "Nature ceaselessly experiments. All living things have evolved through a very long process of trial and error. Although I believe that Lucretius would be comfortable with natural selection, his writings predate Charles Darwin by about 1900 years. There have been many false starts and dead ends, monsters, mistakes, and creatures not able to acquire resources or to procreate. Fortunately, these experiments occasionally give rise to Spot." Lucretius goes on to write, "The universe was not created for or about humans. There are other forms of life now extinct before humans, and there will be other forms of life after us, when we have vanished. Humans are not unique. As Carl Sagan said, we are all star stuff, composed of the same particles as all other life." And finally, as a rude corollary to an atheistic philosophy, Lucretius promotes several conclusions. The soul dies when our bodies die. There is no afterlife. Death is nothing to us. As Lucretius wrote, "Mourners wring their hands in anguish, and they say, 'Never again will your children race for the prize of your first kisses and touch your heart with pleasure too profound for words.'" The mourners do not go on to add, "But you will not care because you won't exist." Although amazingly intuitive, Lucretius was not an atheist. He believed in the cast of gods popular at his time. However, he saw a very real wall of separation between their godly diversions and the rest of us. Nothing that we can ever do could possibly be of interest to them. So where does this leave us? Does lack of belief lead to pessimism, darkness, despair? Is the atheist doomed to lead a life solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short? No. Happiness is greatest among the true believers, and among atheists. It's the nagging doubts of the agnostic that might lead to less than a blissful existence. Scott Alexander, a UU minister in Vero Beach, Florida, hopes that if sometime in your life you will be searching for and sensing something you can call most high and holy, searching for something greater and more gracious than yourself, to whom you can give your praise, your allegiance, your devotion. Dick Hammarskjöld had it right when he said, "God does not die on the day we cease to believe in a personal deity, but we die on the day when our lives cease to be illumined by the steady radiance, renewed daily, of a wonder, the source of which is beyond all reason." Some of you may have been here several years ago when I spoke to the awe that I felt as I emerged from the coastal pines onto the Northern California headlands into an early morning suffused with light. It was a beautiful, beautiful morning. I spoke of being in church that morning. In that moment, I was embraced in a steady radiance of wonder and joy, blessed to be a part of this beauty that was beyond all reason. No, my run that morning was not preordained. It was not a fulfillment of God's minute scheduling of my life when he created the world 6,000 years ago. But there was something within me that knew that that was a special moment, one that will always be with me. Although I favor rationality over faith, I can accept that at that moment I was part of the wonder of billions and billions of happy accidents. Thank you.
An atheistic mindset is, and has always been, my natural condition. But I love to suspend disbelief, to pretend myths are true, to entertain fantastic notions and be entertained by them, to be surprised and to be proven wrong. I'm very experienced at the last one. I don't have to understand an idea or a story fully, or even at all, in order for it to reverberate harmoniously in my ear and brain, like Duke Ellington jazz, a painting by Vermeer, or a surrealistic riff by Weird Al Yankovic, or a meditation by Renee. The secret of living well, said Rachel Raymond, is not in having all the answers, but in pursuing unanswerable questions in good company. I'd like to now spend a few minutes in this excellent company, rhapsodizing and bloviating about the inscrutable origins of the cosmos. Charles Darwin said in reference to the nature of God, quote, "I feel most deeply that the whole subject is too profound for the human intellect. A dog might as well speculate on the mind of Newton," unquote. Quite a laudable display of humility about the limits of the human intellect from one whose intellectual contributions were so great. I am not much swayed by the notion that the universe was created by a pre-existing God, because the idea seems to rest on a logical inconsistency. We could call it the fallacy of the uncreated creator. It seems arbitrary and inequitable to require the universe to have been created, but to exempt the creator of that universe from the same requirement. If we must allow an uncreated thing to exist, I would rather it be the universe itself and spare God the unnecessary labor. Three other possibilities, of course, suggest themselves. Either the universe has always existed, perhaps in various incarnations, or the universe arose spontaneously from nothing, or the universe doesn't really exist. It only seems that way. That last one's a little crazy, but don't you love the harmonious reverberation? The other day, I saw three old guys having coffee at Bob's Diner. They were going back and forth on the subject of hedge apples. They couldn't agree in any aspect of the topic. And finally, they all gave up in disgust, each thinking the other two were hopeless dimwits. First guy says, "Don't you two know anything about Osage oranges?" Second guy says, "What do you mean Osage oranges? I thought we were talking about navel oranges." And the third guy says, "So you're saying that we are not talking about crab apples?" How can you converse meaningfully if you don't agree on the definitions and meanings of words? So you ask me, Do I believe that God created the universe? To me, the question seems meaningless unless you define the term God. We have to both know that we're talking about the same kind of hedge apple. So you say, okay, fine, God has self-awareness, willpower. I say, whoa, that's sufficiently precise. I really don't see how such a God could have created the universe, because self-awareness and willpower are not fundamental forces or primordial concepts. They wouldn't have existed at the dawn of creation. They are recent innovations reflecting a more intricate derivative order of biochemical complexity that first evolved in living creatures like us. The same is true of intelligence, premeditation, curiosity, ambition. Those concepts have no meaning except as manifestations of the mental activity and behavior of living biological creatures. Asking whether I believe in a God that had self-awareness and willpower seems to me like asking whether I believe that God rode up to the creation job site on a bicycle. Self-awareness, willpower, and bicycles did not exist until long after the evolution of some pretty sophisticated living creatures. The creation of the cosmos might have been inevitable, but it could hardly have been intentional. So then you say, and thank you for participating in the conversation, you say, okay, never mind the self-awareness and the bicycle. Do you believe in a God that cannot be known or described? And I say, you have finally redefined God as something I can almost believe in. Because what you're really asking is whether I believe there is a reality that is beyond human comprehension. Yes, I do. But unlike Darwin, I'm not quite so pessimistic about the ability of future generations or of more intelligent creatures in other galaxies to figure out the ultimate secrets of the cosmos. If only we could agree on what a hedge apple is and which God is which, I think real communication could flow, and we might be surprised to find out how much common ground we share. You ask me yet again whether I believe that God created the universe, and this time you tell me that I can define God however I want. Again, I answer the question seems to me meaningless, but this time it's not because of ambiguity about the meaning of the term God. According to astrophysicist Stephen Hawking, asking that question, did God create the universe, however you define God, is like asking directions to the edge of the earth. The earth, of course, is a sphere and thus has no edge. In the same way, time and space did not exist before the Big Bang. So, to paraphrase Gertrude Stein, there was no there. She apparently was referring to her hometown of Oakland, California, but she could just as well have been referring to time before time. There was no time and no place for anything to have happened before the Big Bang. There was no before the Big Bang. There also was no there, since the universe did not expand into pre-existing space. Space didn't exist. Instead, space came into existence to accommodate an expanding universe, like a balloon expanding with the influx of helium. There was no road for God to pedal up on his bicycle and no place to park his bike when he got there. Alice was in Wonderland with Tweedledum and Tweedledee, and they noticed the Red King sound asleep. Tweedledee told Alice the king was dreaming about her, Alice, and warned her not to wake him up, because if his dream ended, Alice would be extinguished like a candle, since she existed only in his dream. Alice began to cry, but then was struck by a reassuring thought. And half laughing through her tears, she blubbered, "If I wasn't real, I shouldn't be able to cry." To which Tweedledee replied with contempt, "I hope you don't suppose those are real tears." I prefer the idea that the cosmos arose spontaneously from nothing, but the idea of reality being dreamed into existence also appeals to me. Such a charming thought. This might seem inconsistent with my distaste for the concept of a pre-existing creator, but we know that imaginary numbers are useful in mathematics. As Scott was saying, that physicists regard imaginary time and antimatter as serious and useful concepts, so I do not dismiss the imaginary, even from musings about the nature of reality. Do you remember the famous words of the noted Unitarian minister, Ralph Waldo Emerson? Quote, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, adored by little statesmen, philosophers, and divines," unquote. Also, don't forget the words of Charles Darwin. "You wouldn't fault a dog for garbled logic or self-contradiction as he speculated on the mind of Newton or as he contemplated the incomprehensible." I had planned on ending my talk by revealing at long last exactly how the cosmos did come into existence. But I see that, as was true at the very beginning, there isn't time. So instead, I close with a poem. If creation itself in all its abundance had never been dreamed or invented, There'd be nothing on earth to argue about, and we'd all be serene and contented. We wouldn't be wondering whether it's true that time has forever existed, or instead whether time didn't used to exist but now does, as some have insisted. Or why is dark energy such an enigma, and why is dark matter unseen? Curiosity wouldn't have prompted such thoughts if the universe never had been. If the cosmos had never arisen, its origins wouldn't be much in dispute. Of course, then we'd have canceled our program today, the topic being thence rendered moot. But what if creation had never existed? How somber, unsettling, and odd. Are we just imagining all this is real? And also, who made God?
Though there is no time, there is time for us to have some discussion in true Unitarian fashion. So please, the mic will be going around. Share your atheistic, non-theistic, secular humanist, agnostic views and how you get through life, or your dissatisfaction with them.
I have to correct something you said. You said that the Israeli people believed in God. 70% of them do not.
Yeah. No, I know, and as we, yeah, so that was Templeton, secular. But, mm-hmm.
I just want to observe that you invited us to express our views, our humanist, atheist,
non-theist, agnostic, secular humanist views, or your dissatisfaction with them, yeah.
Oh, but you didn't ask us to express anything to do with faith or spirituality.
Go for it.
I'm not going to. I just wanted to point that out to you.
I find that as being an atheist from, as we spoke about, kind of a religious community, I'm accustomed to hearing people come up and talk about their spiritual beliefs, and it's, you know, it's different from what I believe, but I'm very calm. But when I hear people talking about atheist beliefs, I have this kind of tendency to want to add placating disclaimers, you know, because you're so used to kind of defending, I'm not insulting you, you know, and so it's kind of nice just to hear a discussion about it and just be calm about it.
I'm Kathy Hedge, and I was a skeptic when I was a kid too, and I'll never forget going to confession because I was a freshman in college, and it was like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm going to go to hell, but I don't even believe in hell, but I'm going to go there anyway. So I went to the priest, and I was in confession, and I said, you know, I just wanted to confess that I'm having doubts, and I really, you know, need to have some support. And he said, well, what are some of your doubts? And I just said a couple of things about what I was learning in ancient history. And he said, well, you shouldn't believe that because, you know, those were written by Protestants.
Michael Oldfather, some of you may have seen a study that was produced at the University of Tennessee by a guy, I wrote it down, Christopher Silver. And they interviewed a whole lot of people who seemed to be atheists or agnostics and divided them into six groups ranging from all of you who don't agree are morons to who gives a damn. But the one that got the most attention, now this is in the University of Tennessee, and so was this one of people that they identified as ritual atheists and agnostics. That is, people who didn't believe anything that they heard about the virgin birth or when the earth was created or a creator or Jesus' resurrection or any of that stuff. But they kept still about it. And because their friends and their family and people they liked and admired and respected were in their churches and they tithed and gave... you know, served on committees and did all of the rest of the stuff, just kept their beliefs to themselves. Well, the most interesting reaction of all came from church people in the South who said, we've got to do something about finding out who these people are who are sitting with us and for all appearances seem to be like us. We've got to root them out. And, you know, but 12.5% of the people in the sample were of that mind. And the sample was heavily weighted toward the South. If they had included more of, say, New England and the West Coast, I wouldn't be surprised if that 12.5% number would have been significantly higher.
I'm Grace McMillan, and I just wanted to talk about like how hard it is being like an atheist parent of young children in Kansas, because religion comes up often in our public school system. Through my kids' friendships, they get invited to, you know, church on Sundays, Grandma's Baptist, and I'm just really thankful that there are communities like this, which is why when I started attending UU services in Topeka when I was pregnant, because I knew I was an atheist, and I knew that I needed to surround my child at that point, my children now, in a community that would accept them on whatever path they chose, especially coming from, you know, going back to what Scott was saying, if you were born, you know, in Calcutta, you'd be Hindu. I knew my kids would probably lean towards accepting my atheist or humanistic tendencies, and I needed to insulate them with acceptance. So thank goodness for you guys.
Diane Barker. I think this is a testament to how reality trumps everything. When I was in high school, my mother wanted to join the Methodist Church. And she wanted me to go with her to the altar for whatever induction, I don't know really what to call it. It wasn't communion, but it was the official acceptance into the church. And I said, well, and the minister scared me because he said, you have to believe this in your heart. You have to be accepting God if you're going to come down here. So my mother said, please come down there with me. And I said, Mother, I can't do that. In my heart, no, I don't believe it. As I was walking down the aisle with my mother, I had the most absurd conversation with what I thought God was at the time. And I'd already been a skeptic, but I, of course, didn't know what I was doing. But I was saying to God, please forgive me. You know I don't believe in you, but I'm doing this for my mother.
Jim Chanteau. When I was a beginning graduate student looking for a topic to spend my career on, I decided that how humans made decisions would be an interesting subject to explore. And indeed, I've now spent nearly 50 years studying that, and I still don't understand how humans make decisions. But I do know that there is a constant desire of humans to make sense out of nonsense. If you present a random sequence of numbers, people will find a pattern. It doesn't matter. That's been shown over and over again. I've shown it a number of times. I've seen it in myself. I remember when I was a graduate student, Doreen and I would go over to Las Vegas, primarily to watch the shows, but we would also play the slot machines. And I would say, you know, there's no pattern to these slot machines. And Doreen said, oh, yes, there is. I said, you know there isn't. She said, I know there isn't, but there is. And I said, well, I know there's not. So I started playing the slot machines, and by God, there's a pattern. That's the point, isn't it? We see patterns in nonsense. And to me, that's the source of a lot of these religious beliefs. I mean, how many people have had coincidences occur? You step on a twig and all of a sudden you see the light or something like that. It just seems to me that happens over and over to people. And so there's just this human tendency to want to explain things that may be totally inexplicable.
I've shared with some of you that my parents sent us to Catholic school because they wanted us to have something to rebel against so we would move toward atheism. And it worked out. It really worked for us. But what I've reflected on a lot lately, I've missed my dad because I have a 13-year-old girl, who many of you know, who's over the past couple years constantly asking me questions about why people believe in a God and what does it mean not to believe in that. She expresses a lot of the same kind of doubt that I heard beautifully expressed here today. And I can't quite be the kind of parent my dad was. I wish I could. And when I reflect on it, he was really a very deep existentialist. And the thing that he gave us to hold on to as hope was some sense of free will, which I know is a contested idea. But having the idea that in some small way you have power in your own sphere was a hopeful idea that gave us enough, and we didn't need some bigger God or something to believe in. Well, so now that I know right here at UU, all of you are as eloquent in explaining that as my dad, I'm going to insist that my daughter listen to this podcast. So thank you.
Ken Embers, I just want to make a comment that I have some sort of reverence for God or something like this, because I always notice that it could be just a cultural learning thing, but I always notice when I get really angry and mad and upset, I don't say "darn it" or "golly" or "gee." It's "God damn it!"
Sylvia Beeman. While I'm a great proponent of logic and reason, I also pay attention to my intuitive feelings. And I think there are things, ways of knowing inside us that maybe we don't have words for, can't be expressed, or that we come up against things we've never experienced before. And I pay attention to what my intuitive feelings, and I use my logic and reason to try and figure out why I feel that way. And I think, like you talking to the children about being humanists or how we raise our children, we are developing their instinctive feelings, which often guide us in the things that impinge on us every second of our lives. You don't always have time to sit down and reflect about everything that happens to you. So I think that my logic and my reason guide my instinctive, reflexive development of those feelings.
Well, I guess I kind of have two things to say, one based on my own experiences and one is kind of a question. I've been living in Russia for the past year, and as you may know, the Russian Orthodox Church is not an upholder of the progressive tradition. And when I talk to a lot of Russian people about their religion, they say, "Well, yes, I'm Orthodox." I say, "Do you go to church every Sunday?" "Well, no, no." "Do you uphold the tenets of the faith?" "No." Do you believe in the divinity of Christ?" "And nah, not really." "Well, why then do you say you're Orthodox?" And they say, "Well, because I'm Russian. It's just who I am." So as far as atheism go, I'd like to kind of speak to the courage that it takes to kind of question not only this guy in the sky who's calling all the shots, but a part of your own identity. And a lot of people have kind of stepped outside of their family's comfort zone. So I commend those who have done that. The second thing that I wanted to say is a lot of churches have a lot of evangelical missions, and they try and spread the church, and it's part of the faith to spread it. And I don't know, kind of a question. One is, what's the best way for atheism's sort of evangelicism, if that is a thing? And the second is that, Are atheism and organized religions in inherent conflict, or can they peacefully kind of coexist?
Good questions, but in fact, it is now, I think, time. So I think that's a perfect set of questions for us to leave on. So join me now in singing hymn number 134, Our world is one world. Humans are amazing creatures. We are capable of many great and many horrible things. We can think, we can reason, we can feel, we can join together in community, we can talk. So let us do all these things. Let us work together and through discussion, community, action, do as the kids sing, help each other learn, and search for what is true. Have a good Sunday.